Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Golf Talk Live. I'm your host, Ted Odorico, and we're gearing up here just a moment for another segment of Coach's Corner. And before I do that, I just want to quickly remind everybody that we are live on blogtalkradio.com right now from 6 p.m. Central Standard Time to 8 p.m. And we're going to be starting here in just a moment or two, the Coach's Corner. But if you want to call in during the live broadcast, you can do so at area code 646-716-4667. Or you can email me at ted.golftalklive@gmail.com if you have any questions throughout the program or any comments that you want to make. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook at Golf Talk Live Blog. And you can also get me on Twitter at TedandBuckCEO. And when you have a chance, surf the Internet, and you can check out the website at golftalkliveblog.com. As I said, we're getting ready to start another segment of Coach's Corner, and a little bit later in the broadcast, I'm going to be joined by none other than Bruce Baird. He is the founder of the Nationwide Golf Schools, and he's got some interesting things to talk about this evening. He's going to be joining me a little bit later in the broadcast. But in the meantime, let me bring up my two gentlemen this evening that are joining me on the Coach's Corner panel. First off is Mr. Lloyd Higley. He's a PGA teacher professional at the Chicagoland Golf Academy up in the windy north there. We'll bring him out in just a second. And following close behind him is, of course, Mr. John Dunnigan, PGA master professional at the John Dunnigan Golf Academy. Gentlemen, welcome to Golf Talk Live.
Hey, thank you for having us.
Not a problem. I appreciate having you guys back. Good to have you back on the panel. And just before we start, guys, into some questions, I just want to remind the listeners that are tuning in live that each Thursday night we're going to be starting the Golf Talk Live program with a segment of Coach's Corner. It's going to last roughly about an hour, and this gives you an opportunity if you want to call in. That's great. Otherwise, I've got some email questions here ready to go that some of you have been sending in over the last few months in preparation for this, and this will give you an opportunity to pick the brains of some of the best coaches and teacher pros in the golf business today. And each week I'm going to have a different panel put together, and we're going to cover a different topic. And, of course, I've got a topic picked out for this week, which I'm going to let the guys in on in just a moment here. And also to help out some of you weekend warriors during the live broadcast, you can certainly call into the number again, and I'll give you that in just a minute. Here's how the segment's going to work. Each week I'll pose some questions to the panel for discussion. We'll start the discussion and then rotate around to each of the members for some general comments and then open the floor to any additional comments. Afterwards, we'll take some live calls if we have any, and if not, we'll go through the email questions that I've been sifting through over the last few weeks. So this is your opportunity to participate tonight in the discussion, so you can call anytime during the live broadcast from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. Central Standard Time, or that 7 to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for you East Coasters. Number to call again is area code 646-716-4667, or you can email your questions to questions.golftalklive@gmail.com. Guys, we're going to start off this week with, I think, a pretty obvious question. I know I sent it to you out in the email, but just to refresh your memory, I wanted to talk about working through the first tee jitters. And a gentleman by the name of Bill, who's 35 years old, he didn't tell me where he was from, but here's quickly what he put together for me. He said he plays about 2 to 3 rounds a week during peak season, so I'm gathering he's probably up north in your neck of the woods there, Lloyd, but still manages to get extremely nervous on the first tee. Do you have any tips that can help me out? Lloyd, you want to start us off?
Yeah, I'll start it off. Well, you know, I remember reading that Tiger says that he still gets nervous on the first tee, so it's common. It's common for most people, or just about everybody, to be a little nervous on the first tee. First off, the obvious. Get to the range before you start your round. Warm up a little bit. Get loosened up just a little bit as far as your swing goes. Then right before you're going to go to the first hole, if it's a course you've played before, you know what that first hole is like, and play that hole on the range. So say like my home course starts off with a long par 5, big wide fairway. I could hit driver off it. I would hit a driver, and I would set myself up on the range to say, okay, here's where the trees are on the right, here's where the trees are to the left, and here's my fairway. My second shot's going to be a 5-iron that's going to set me up for a 100-yard or less shot into the green. So I would play those three clubs and play one ball for my drive, one ball for my 5-iron, and one ball for my sand wedge going into the green. So I've kind of prepared myself for it. That's the one first right. tip that I would do. Play that first hole in your on the driving range. Get to the range. Warm up a little bit.
Sounds good. Sounds good. John, any thoughts that you want to add to that?
I thought that was good, Lloyd. What I would suggest is, first of all, you need to make sure that you're practicing a lot of drivers. And don't, you know, I have a new saying. It's called drive for show, drive for dough. So make sure you're getting a lot of it. But when you're practicing, keep in mind that the reason for practice is to figure out exactly the feel or the concept or the idea or whatever kind of image it is that gives you a sense of when I do this, the ball will go there. Now, when you are nervous, first of all, if you still know that, you can still, despite the fact that you are actually nervous as you're excited to play, you can choose to look at it as a negative, but really you're just excited to play. So you
right.
could, you can still execute that sense that you have of, you know, when I do this, that's what I believe we should be practicing all the time anyway. When I do this, I predict that's coming. There's a little bit more to it, though. You know, one of the things that I have had a lot of success with folks is when they do get to the first tee to take kind of their time but use it kind of differently. This is kind of weird. I kind of like to have people, you know, breathing. You know, breathe in, mm-hmm. count of four, slowly and deep. Breathe out, count of four, hold it for another second, and do that again. And then they could even do something as crazy as, okay, I want you to now visualize, take a practice swing, and visualizing the golf ball going straight out of bounds or a horrible result.
Mm-hmm.
Then take another review swing, okay, and then start to see it doing good stuff. Because, you know, the second guy can play. That's a big saying in golf. So go ahead and let yourself see yourself hit one bad and then correct it. Then jump in there and try to hit the golf shot. Breathing, realize, hey, you're playing golf. You could be working like Lloyd and I. So,
yeah.
you know, it's not
yeah.
that bad.
yep.
It is just a game.
Go
ahead, Lloyd.
Well, just to add to that, Fred Schumacher, who wrote the book Extraordinary Golf, who I spent a lot of time with, once said to me that made a lot of sense. He said, what if I told you that in the 18 holes of golf you're about to play, your first hole you were going to mess up? You were going to triple bogey it, double bogey it, whatever a mess up is to you. And I'd say I'd be bummed out. I'd be upset. He goes, then what if I told you the next 17 holes were going to be the best 17 holes you ever played in your life? Would you take that first hole?
Well, sure.
I love Fred.
I said, you're darn tootin' I would. You know, and back to what John was saying, I remember a long time ago when those Eddie Marin's tapes came out and Dave Faraday was, pitching him and all that, and he said one of the first things that Eddie told him about as far as first tee jitters was take your golf ball and just kind of throw it up in the air real small, just little gentle tosses up in the air from one hand to another, and just let yourself relax. And if that first tee box you have to hit a driver and you've never played this course before and a driver is killing you or that's the club that kills you, why not tee off with a hybrid? Get yourself in play. Get away from those people that are on the first tee that are all watching you, that you're making you yep. nervous because you don't want to screw up in front of them. Take the club you're most confident with. Get it out there in the fairway. Get out there with your three buddies and then start playing golf and then whip out that driver.
If I could add one more thing to that, one of my favorite sayings
sure.
is, when in doubt, air it out. When people do get into a situation where they're a little nervous, they usually try to steer the golf ball into play, or they try to not make a mistake. And I tell them, well, go ahead, give it hell. You know, swing hard in case you hit it, that sort of thing, because they just seem to fall apart when they slow down.
Yep.
Yeah, and those are some great points, guys, and that's so true. You know, I think really, you know, obviously the pros, as you mentioned earlier, you know, even Tiger still, I'm sure to this day, has some first tee jitters, and that's just normal and common, especially when you're standing at some of the courses and everybody's lining up, the carts are lining up at the first tee, and you've got yourself a little audience, and if you're not used to playing in that kind of pressure, of course it's going to mount. But I think that's some great sound advice for Bill, and, you know, from both of you, and I think that they're you really have to you have to sort of put that trouble out of your mind. And a couple of ways to do that is, as Lloyd has suggested, one of the ways that you can do it is to go to that practice tee, make sure that you've got in the range, come a few minutes before you're ready to play, and visualize playing that first hole, especially if it's a course that you've played many times before. Visualize playing that hole shot by shot, and that way prepare mentally. Or the other option is to put away the driver for off the first tee and hit a club that you're maybe a little bit more comfortable about, using as opposed to the driver, and wait till you get out to the second hole and beyond. And thirdly, John, you raised some good points. Well, breathing as well is very, very important. I think that, if you take some deep breaths in and deep breaths out, and just, maybe count to four going in and four going out, and just relax and just focus on the task at hand, and not worry about what's going on behind you. Just sort of look forward down the fairway and even visualize hitting that terrible shot, and then regroup and focus on hitting good shots after that. And as you indicated, if somebody hits a bad, plays the first hole badly, they've got 17 more to follow up on. So it's plenty of golf left in the game. So don't be worried, Bill, on that first tee. Great suggestions, guys. Okay, we're going to move on to some email questions that we've got. And the first one we've got is from Jordan from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And Jordan reads off here. He says, "Thanks for reading out my question. I play fairly often but still struggle with my overall game. I shoot in about the mid-90s. My drives are decent but tend to spray right, and then they go when they go wrong. I have an okay short game, but my putting needs help. I three-putt more than I would like. Do you have some suggestions or drills that can help me with my putting?" John, we're going to let you start off.
Well, first I'd like to say, go Flyers. I just wanted to bring that up. That's an important thing.
Yeah.
So now we've just lost another viewer. Darn. In any case, what I would I gave this lesson to a tour player. I would go out and spend the first, give me 3 weeks of the season. The only thing you practice with putting is speed control. I don't care whether the ball goes in the hole at all.
Yep.
Simply try to get the ball to stop, especially from 15 feet and in, about a foot, maybe 2 feet. Give yourself an end zone between a foot and 2 feet beyond the cup.
Yep.
Now, sometimes the hole's going to get in the way of the ball anyway. But what I find is when people are trying to make putts, it's kind of funny. They put their mind solely on the line, and then their speed goes haywire.
Yeah.
And maybe you can focus a little bit more on speed on shorter putts, 3- and 4-footers, where, maybe you could take some of the breakup. But I still think if I can get people to just focus on their speed and get that done, more balls will finish around the hole. If more balls finish around the hole, then over time more balls have to have gone in.
Yep. Great great advice. Lloyd, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, that's great advice. Obviously speed control or distance control is key for putting. And a thing that I do with my students is when you're looking at, say, like what Johnny said, say you're 15 feet away from the hole. What people have a tendency of doing is they have a tendency of looking at the distance between their ball to the beginning of the hole. And so they're making a look at that way. What I like to get them to do is to look beyond the hole, to put that hole in perspective of where is that hole in relationship to 2 more feet beyond that hole. And then to set a couple of tees, like what John said, like an end zone or a goal post, beyond the hole, and then aim to get it within that 2 feet, beyond the hole. Always look beyond the hole. Don't look from the hole to your ball. A couple little drills that I like to do with them is, and I'm a big believer in one-handed putting just to get a little bit more consistent stroke, whether you're a left-handed dominant player or a right-handed dominant player. I like taking a little one-handed strokes to try to feel how much further back do I got to bring the ball or my hand back, and how much forward do I bring it, and what distance did I just go back and forth, and how far did that ball roll? Okay, now if I go back another 4 inches and I go forward another 4 inches, how much did that add to my length of that putt? So you get start getting a feel for how much do I have to move my shoulders, my arms, my left arm, right arm, to get a feel for the distance. So you put a ball maybe 4 feet from the hole, you put a ball 8 feet from the hole, you put a ball 12 feet from the hole, you put a ball 16 feet from the hole, all on the same line, and just start getting used to how much of a stroke, a long stroke, because it's not, it's the distance that you're making your stroke, which is going to make the ball go further. So you want to just think about the length of stroke instead of how hard do I have to hit it. Because hard is nothing. You know, I could go to John and say, John, you got to hit that ball harder. So then he hits it harder. And then I go, well, you hit that one too hard. Now you got to hit it softer. And then he hits it soft. So what is his hard versus what is my hard? Now, if I tell him to lengthen or shorten that stroke, then he has a better idea. So that's what you want to start looking at, is the length of your stroke to go certain distances and to look beyond the hole.
Can I add one more thing to that, please?
You certainly can.
So one thing when doing putting drills like what Lloyd was just describing, I have people do the short, long, or good. So that is, you know, from whatever distance you're putting, it's a way that I get people to wake up their sense of feel. So now we're putting that 15-footer. And before you look up, just from the feel of contact, try to guess, did it finish short of the cup? Did it finish long, 2 feet away or farther? Or did it finish in that little 2 foot end zone? And as you get better, by the way, I'd like that to be about a 1 foot or 1 foot and a half end zone. And what you'll do is the first bunch of putts that you hit, you'll go, I have no idea. because you're not accustomed to having that great a sense of what you're doing, or you'd already be a great putter, right? So what happens very quickly, in just a few minutes, people start going, oh my gosh, I can feel it now. And that's how you develop your feel. It works wonderfully.
Yep. And I'll add one little thing to that, and this is a story. I think I told this to Ted last time we talked privately. Mm-hmm. Years ago, 1999, I was at a driving range in Palm Springs with Fred Schumacher, and at that time, the guy who was had been the number one player in the world, and they were having me hit balls, and I would hit balls with my, not putts, but hit balls, and I couldn't look up to see where the ball went, and I had to tell them just by the feel of that ball on my club face and how my club face was oriented to my start line, did that ball go left? Did that ball go right? Did that ball go straight? Did that ball go high? Did that ball go low? Did I hit it off the toe? Did I hit it off the heel? Or did I hit it off the leading edge?
Beautiful.
And I'll tell you one thing, it really brings your sense of feel of everything into play. That's a great point, John.
Let me just add something here, too. I think that, to help in putting, I think one of the things, as Jordan had mentioned here in his email, that, for the most part, his game is okay. He's, hitting some bad drives here and there, but that can be worked out in the range, and he indicated as well as his short game is okay, which tells me, obviously, all of his golf game needs help. If he's hitting in the 90, he still needs some help here. But one thing, and I want to address the putting here a little bit more. How much time, if somebody is going to go, let's say, and I'm not talking about before a round of golf, I'm talking if they want to go up to a range or into an academy, let's break down how much time should they be allotting to their long game, their short game, and I take putting as separate. In their putting, how much of the time of their range time should be dedicated to each area? And, John, you go ahead and start that off.
Well, there's a really, really good book that just came out this month. It's called Every Shot Counts, and it's a statistical analysis using the ShotLink data done by a guy named Mark Brody, who's a Columbia, genius. And, I might have said, give me a third of the time on each discipline. I might have said that. If you're going to divide up your practice, give me one third of, if you have an hour, give me 20 minutes long game,
yeah.
20 minutes short wedging around the greens, 20 minutes putting. I might have to rethink that and have people spend a silly amount of time on driver and about 175-yard shot. Mm-hmm. Using his what he's found. Now, of course, we would tailor that to the individual golfer's strengths and weaknesses. But if I had to say what's killing people the most, they don't get the driver in play and their approach shots are not good.
Yeah.
So they really have not much chance of scoring well. Now, if indeed our golfer says, you know what, I do get off the tee all the time and I hit the golf ball 200 yards in the middle of the fairway all the time, I might say, from 200 yards, it's going to be really hard to score because you got too long a shot into the green. But let's say he's out there 250
right.
and steady. Now I go, okay, well, check that one off. That one's passing the test. Let's see how your approach shots go in. And then I would tailor it to each person. But I from what I'm reading, and I've only been reading it for a couple of weeks, but the math says, driving and approach shots are really big. Of course, if a guy is three putting a lot, then mm-hmm. I've got to go with, well, okay, but how close is he hitting the ball to the hole? Because if he's three putting from 40 feet, that makes him kind of almost a tour player. If he's three putting from 60 feet, guess what? That's coming. And we've got to get the golf ball closer to the hole.
Right.
Isn't that an interesting, horrible answer? But
yeah.
Hey, I concur on that. But it does make a lot of sense because, and obviously, when they're submitting in a lot of these questions, we're not getting the full story all the time, and you're
right.
sort of getting little snippets here. But obviously, if somebody, the one thing that in sort of the old school of thought was, if somebody's putting was not great, get them out there for half an hour and so, and do all these different putting games and things like that are true. But let's not forget the other part of the game as well. John, as you had just mentioned, if he's not getting it close to the pin and he's putting from 60 feet away all the time, maybe he needs to work on his approach shots a little bit more and getting closer, and that might also help to reduce his three putts as well. Because if you're putting from the other side of the green all the time, whether it be back or front, of course your putting is not going to do well. And I suspect, because he also started off, Jordan had indicated that, he tended to spray to the right with his drive. So obviously he's not getting into the fairway all the time consistently either, which is subsequently not going to set him up for his second shot. So he's going to have to either play it back out to the fairway, depending on what his lie and so forth. So there's a lot of variables there, but I think you really have to assess, John, as you indicated, you have to sort of assess each player based on their overall performance before you can really sort of put together a plan on where and how they should practice, correct?
Yes.
I agree.
Okay.
Yeah,
the first thing I do is put them through a pretty vigorous test if I get a new student and see how they do. And that usually leads us right where to go.
Right, and to John's point, what he was talking about with Mark Brody's book, which I haven't got yet, but I know exactly where John's going with this because us instructors talk about this all the time, what our old thoughts were, a lot of stuff in golf instruction is rooted in just things that have been said for years, and all of a sudden now it's accepted as that's the truth, when we're finding out now what a lot of science, which John and I talk about a lot, and all of us talk about, and statistics from Richie Threejack and Mark Brody, is that some of the stuff that we thought about, you know, this old, you know, putt for show, you know, drive for show, putt for dough, and all this other stuff, doesn't necessarily hold up. And, you know, it reminds me back of, I remember reading this about what Hogan, when he came home one time when before he really was, you know, made it big, came home to his wife, and he goes, I'm just not making a lot of birdies. And she said to him, well, hit it closer to the flag, hit it closer to the hole. And it was like a revelation to Ben. And he goes, hey, you know what? If I do get it closer to the hole, I will make more birdies. So your gentleman who wrote that says, well, my short game is pretty good. Well, let's take a look at that short game, because you're telling us now that you're three-putting a lot. Okay, so unless you're three-putting from 6 feet, which, well, then you definitely got some putting problems. But you're not putting, you're not three-putting from 6 feet. You're putting from, so it leads me to say, okay, well, if this student came to me, I'd say, okay, let's take a look at your for him, his long iron game may be, you know, 150 in or 160 in or 170 in, and say, okay, we got to work on that. Okay, now let me take a look at your chip shots. Well, your short game isn't really that good because, you know, you haven't put a ball within 15 feet of the hole out of the 10 balls I just put here right off the side of the green. So you'll be surprised at how your approach shots and tuning up your short game, your chipping game, all of a sudden your putting is going to get a whole lot better.
Well, sure.
That's the truth.
And that's true. And that's true. Guys, let's move on. We've got another question here from Frank from Duluth, Georgia. Good old Southern boy here. He's kind of really in – he falls into the category we were just talking about. My game for the most part is good. I have difficulty with my approach shots to the green. I'm either long or short. Can you help me tighten up my approach shots? So that sort of leads right into that question or conversation. So how do we help somebody that has a problem with their approach shots? They're obviously driving it into the fairway a good amount of the time. He doesn't seem to be struggling or indicating he's struggling with his putting, but he's having difficulty getting it onto in good place on the green. So how do we help that golfer? And Lloyd, let's start with you.
Okay. Well, I mean, he's saying that he's either long or short. Number one thing that pops into my head is that does he know the distances that he's hitting each of his irons? Okay, for one. And what type of contact is he making? So, I mean, let's just throw in some numbers out there. He's got a 7-iron. He hits it 150 yards. He says, listen, I hit my 7-iron 150 yards. You know, you get them on TrackMan, you get them on FlightScope, you get them on some type of launch monitor or something like that. You test out his yardages, and you find out exactly, okay, well, you know, on these 10 strikes here, you know, you were, you're that's your 150-yard club. Now, why are you hitting it long or short on certain holes? Well, it could be that he gets nervous when he's out there. He's putting a lot of pressure on himself. I got to get this ball on the green. My buddy just got it on the green there, and then he chunks it and he hits it a little bit fat, and it comes up a little short. And then his next time he's got that shot, he hits this baby flush and he puts it over there. So that would be some of the work that you would look at. Number one, how far are you hitting your irons? Are you sure that's how far you hit your irons? Because John and I both know, and any golf instructor knows, these people think they're hitting their irons or they think they're hitting their driver certain yardages. And when we put them on that FlightScope or that TrackMan, they ain't hitting them there, you know.
Right. Let me, John, before I move on to you, let me just interject something here. Another thing that I've seen over the years as well while instructing is, and this is something that was really, really common. I mean, obviously with the technology and that today, we can be much more proficient. But one of the things that I think that a lot of golfers maybe misunderstand, and Lloyd, I'm going to use your example here to further the point. If a golfer's hitting his 7-iron 150 yards, let's say on average, and let's say that is accurate, one of the problems that a lot of golfers don't understand is their distance to the green might be 150 yards, but where to the green is that 150 yards? And a lot of times they may not need that 7-iron. It may be an 8-iron shot that they really need to be playing. So this could also explain why he's hitting it long and short. If it's 150 to the center of the green and the pin's in the back and he's hitting a 7-iron to the middle of the green, well, then he's got a good shot that ball is going to roll closer to the hole. But conversely, if it's 150 yards to the center of the green and the pin's cut in the front, now he's going to overshoot the pin, and he's, again, going to be rolling. So this is something that people, I think, need to understand as well, is when they're putting together their yardage, where is that yardage giving it to, and make sure you understand all, you know, to the front of the green, to the back of the green, bunkers and that sort of thing. Make sure you understand that information before you select your club. John, you go ahead.
Right. So along with what Lloyd was saying, I would start out with, you know, my thing is the essential skills of golf. And for ball control skill, it's how solid is the strike. You know, if I put you on the old test, how many solid strikes do you hit out of 10, for instance? So if the ball's being struck solidly, okay, good. Well, we get to check that off. Now, what type of shot are you trying to hit? And can you actually prove to me that you can hit it? So, for instance, if Lloyd comes to me and he goes, well, Donegan, I'm trying to hit the ball dead straight because I'm that good. And I go, okay, let's try it out. And, okay, there's a target 160 yards away. Go ahead. And if he proceeds to show me that, indeed, he can hit it straight, then that's his stock shot. But if a person is trying to hit it straight and he's got three-way misses where they do go straight occasionally and right and left, now he's got no idea what's coming. So I would say solid contact, then one, predict the flight. Try to hit, instead of three-way golf, right, left, and center, get it to center and right or center and left.
Right.
That just halved your shot dispersion area. That's a friendly thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then
I
would consider hitting every golf ball, regardless of where the flagstick is, to the dead center of the green.
Mm-hmm.
Don't go at a single flagstick. Jason Day, leader in par three scoring average, I think it was last year. Jason Day's philosophy is, I don't care what the club is, I'm going to the center of the green. That's it.
Yep.
I thought that's just genius. So now there's one last third part to this, which is in the case that you have junk on one side or the other of the green. Then what I want you to have is your new only two-way golf misses, and I want you to hit the golf ball in between the flagstick and the side of your best miss.
Yep.
There you go. You're a better golfer today.
And to help that the person who wrote in on that stuff, you know, there's certain things. You know, you can play a hole and you can look at it and go, wow, that's a short 150. Or you can play a hole and go, boy, that's a long 150. You know, what is it that makes one look shorter than another? Well, these golf course architects are diabolical people. We all know that, all right? they set up golf courses, and there's hills and little valleys that you may not see that makes a hole look shorter to you. Or there's things that are going uphill that makes that hole look a lot longer. So 150 is not necessarily just 150. You've got to take into account the wind. You've got to take into account the uphill versus the downhill. What are you seeing? And again, what Johnny was saying, you know, go for the fat of the green. And where is that 150 at? And can I hit a low shot that's going to penetrate through that wind versus maybe I'm going to hit a high shot that's going to float on that wind or ride that wind? That the 150 will be maybe an 8-iron this time, or that 150 may be a 6-iron this time. So you've got to learn to be able to take your 6-iron and hit your 150 shot with that 6-iron. Maybe take a 5-iron and say, hey, I'm going to learn how to hit a 150 shot with a 5-iron, with a 3/4 swing, with a half swing. So adjusting the length of your swing and having good solid ball contact and adjusting the flight of your ball, then you start becoming better with being able to judge your distances.
Some excellent points, guys,
that
I think that Frank in Georgia has got some great advice to handle those approach shots, and it's so true. It's so important that people understand. And John, you raised a really great point for those golfers that maybe are not as consistent. If they can tighten that down to two, either straight and left or straight and right, it's much like the old theory of, you know, if you're a chronic slicer, let's say. You want to eliminate that part of the fairway, and, you know, you want to set up in such a way that you're going to get the optimal opportunity to put the ball in play. And it's the same thing when you're doing with your approach shots. If you can eliminate that one side or that one area, whether it be left or right, that's going to increase your chances of success as well. So that was some great advice, guys, both of you.
Yep.
We're going to move on to another gentleman from Huntsville, Alabama, regularly, but he's currently actually overseas. And here's this message here, and you'll understand why. I currently serve in the military, so my golf game is whenever I can fit it in between deployments. I'm currently deployed right now. Can't say where, of course. We have limited time, and he's referring to his gang over there. We have limited time, but we do on occasion have a chance to play. So obviously they're playing in conditions over there. We play in a makeshift course, which is like hardpan. What can we do to help play in these conditions? What can we offer? Thanks, and PFC Benjamin. Let's start with John.
Jeepers, creepers. Thank you for your service. You are
first and foremost.
Boy, yeah, first and foremost, and you know, I just can't speak highly enough about the men and women in our armed forces. So again, Godspeed. I hope you guys get home soon. Hardpan, huh?
Perfect.
He's
obviously. Yeah, he's playing in some dry conditions, obviously, so it gives us a pretty good idea where he is, and let's see if we can help these guys over there with and get ready for when they come back home to play some real golf over here.
Okay, you ready?
Yeah.
Here's what I want you to do. You have got possibly one of the greatest solid contact training aids in the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
Dirt. Yeah. I want you to draw a line in the dirt. I'd like you to put your club behind that line like you were addressing a ball that was on that line, but don't do it with a ball yet. And all I want you to do is start out by taking full speed swings, normal, you know, and trying to touch the ground on the front side of that line. Okay? And this is huge. And I want to see how consistent. So you'll, let's say you make a line that is 4 feet long. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So this line is kind of perpendicular to your stance line. And I want you to take one divot, move down the line a couple inches, you know, address another ball which is further down the line. Do it again. I want to see how close those divots are to hitting the ground in the same spot relative to that line. Now, that sounds real easy. Wait till you get out there and try that sucker. It's real hard to do. So you're going to learn how to hit the ground in the same spot consistently. So that's number one. You can't be in a better place to have to learn that. Then, once you get feeling real sexy about that, go ahead and put a golf ball on that line. I mean, Lloyd and I do this with turf grass market paint the time on the driving range. So this is huge. Now, one thing that you should also know is you always hit the golf ball first anyway. So hard pan isn't really that big a deal.
Right.
The ball's already gone by the time the club hits the ground. But, you know, in our case, as all three of us golf teachers, people do not consistently hit the ball than the turf or the dirt.
No.
So that you're in a perfect opportunity to really master that essential skill of golf.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Perfect.
And go ahead. And to add what John, you know, John's saying, what, you know, he's talking about getting your low point and hitting the ball first and then hitting the ground. What amateurs and high handicappers are afraid of, or what they're used to, is they're used to a ball that's fluffed up on a, you know, maybe a public course where the fairways aren't real tight, like PGA Tour fairways. And even a lot of amateurs don't mind a ball that's in the rough as long as it's sitting up and it looks like it's teed up for them. They love that. They love that. So, you know, that's, whoa, baby, all right, you know. But the bottom line is, John, what John said is you guys have an opportunity there. You know, you may want to move the ball a little bit back in your stance a tad. You may want to set up with your hands a little bit forward at address. I'm not talking major forward. I'm talking a little bit forward at address. And then you want to, you know, as you're going through your swing and you're doing the drill that John told you, you'd like to make sure that your pressure is going towards your forward left leg. If you're a righty, your left leg that you've got your pressure going forward, or for amateurs, your weight going forward. You're not swinging off of your back foot there, and you're not trying to lift the ball up in the air and flipping your fingers or flipping your wrist at the ball. You know, like what John said, if you guys could get good at hitting the ball there, I mean, that's Lee Trevino. You know, those boys from Texas, man, they're hitting the ball off a hard pan. A lot of those public courses down there, man, they don't have a lot of grass down there. And those, you know, Muni courses, and, I mean, that's what Lee Trevino was doing. Boy, he was smacking that ball off a hard pan. If you guys can get good at that over there, when you come back home, you're going to be taking a lot of money from your buddies.
Yep.
Let me just inject a couple of things, and then I'm going to move on, because there's another aspect of this question I want to ask you guys. You know, when I was first learning to play this great game many, many, many years ago now, that was exactly what my father used to do. He was the one that really sort of got me started, and he would actually go to an area in the range that had several, you know, divots taken out. And, of course, over the course of the day, the sun would bake out some of those divots, and he would actually put the ball. He would find an area, a little square or something, where there are, you know, two or three divots side by each, and he would actually have me hit balls from within those divots, which was essentially the same thing, just off the dirt. And I didn't get those nice, lush, fluffy lies to start. And he would do that for that very reason, was he wanted to see. And he would sometimes, depending on how big it was, he would etch a little line in there, and he would do that very drill that, John, you were talking about at the beginning.
Yep.
And that's how he taught me to make good solid contact on the ball, was to play from the dirt and not from the lush grass. So that was a great great point that you made. Now, I want to change it slightly here, because I think there's another aspect, even though he doesn't actually, Benjamin doesn't mention this in the email, but because they're playing in the conditions that they are, obviously they want to make great contact, but because they don't have that lush grass to stop their shots on, they're probably getting a little extra roll and bounce and whatnot like that. How do they adjust while they're over there? Obviously, when they come back, it's a different kettle of fish, but when they're over there, how can they adjust to make it a little bit easier for them?
Well, I mean, obviously what you're saying is that they're going to get a lot of roll and bounce. And you know, and that's part of the game. You know, bad bounces, good bounces, you know, whatever. So, you know, back to what we were talking about with that gentleman with the 150 yards. Well, for them, 150 yards to the center of the green may not be where you want to hit this ball. You may want to hit this ball 135 yards because you're going to get a lot of bounce and you're going to get a lot of roll, you know. That type of stuff is really hard to give somebody advice on until you really see what they're experiencing. But again, the opportunity that they have there to play under conditions that most people don't find is something that they should look at as a plus and not necessarily as a minus. You're going to to learn how to play the game for the conditions you have. And if it means a lot of bump and runs instead of high floating shots, then it's bump and runs, you know, chip shots like that, pitch shots like that, playing the little bounces. Now, you're going to get a bad bouncer. It's going to hit off a rock, and it's going to kick to the right or kick to the left, and that's part of the game.
Very true. Good point to wrap that up. Once again, Benjamin, we want to thank from all of us here on Golf Talk Live, and particularly Coach's Corner, we want to thank you again for you and your other comrades over there. Thank you very much for your service for this great nation, and we appreciate it. We Godspeed, as John had said, that you get back safe and sound, and we hope that these tips have helped you and your friends over there in your golf game. We hope that helps, and we hope that you come back to play much more golf here back in the U.S. Thank you very much for Benjamin for submitting that, and as John said, Godspeed to get home. And let's move on to Rick from San Diego, California, and Rick's question starts off, my short game can use some help. I don't seem to make very crisp contact with my irons. Do you have any drills that can help me be more consistent? So it kind of falls in a little bit similar to what the other ones that we've talked about, but let's see if we can approach this a little bit differently. Lloyd, I'm going to start you off on this one. Let's help Rick out in San Diego be a little bit better iron player. What are some things that he can do to do that?
Well, I'm assuming he's talking about a short game being something like 100 yards and in. One of my favorite drills is basically what John just was talking about, is that is I like to stick maybe if I'm on a grass range, I'll stick a tee, you know, 2 inches in front of the ball or 3 inches in front of the ball, and have that person, you know, hit a ball, but their focus is on the hitting that tee, and the ball is just going to get in the way. They'll make a little bit more solid contact. As far as little short game tips and that, you know, the biggest thing that I think that I see and with a lot of amateurs is when they do the little, say, 40-yard little pitch shot or maybe a little bit less of a chip shot, is they'll on their takeaway, they bring the club way too far back behind them, and then they kind of run their arms at it, and they leave no body. They don't use any body. I try to get my students when they're doing like a little 20, 30-yard shot is to basically – and again, it's not for everybody, but for most people, take the club kind of straight back, let that club come in just a little bit, but have that face looking at the ball the whole time you're bringing it back. Don't let that face turn away from the ball looking up. So as you're going back, you have that face looking at the ball, and then allow the body and keeping your knees soft and keeping your arms soft through impact. Especially with little baby chip shots that are maybe 5, 10, 15-yard shots, I think that people get too armsy and don't allow the body to help them move that club. And I remember I did a thing with Dave Wetzlick once. We were doing some little short pitches and all that stuff. And it basically is keep those knees with the short little chips, little pitch shots, keep those knees soft and keep those arms soft going through, like Seve used to do with, you know, putting that sword back into the sheath, put it just in there. Let that come through. Keep your chest in your setup a little bit more in front of the ball, pointed in front of the ball, maybe the buttons on your shirt instead of having them at the ball. Start off with them pointed maybe 45 degrees in front of the ball. Just take that club straight back, straight through, little pitch shots, little chip shots like that. And as far as solid contact, the drill that Johnny was talking about is a great drill for solid contact.
Perfect. John, you want to add to that?
Sure. So let's talk about in close, as Lloyd was talking. And I'm going to give you a little bit more external focus. Like, what are you trying to do with the golf club? You know, again, we talked about where the club hits the ground. But I think around the green that there are a lot of folks – who are perhaps hitting down on the ball entirely too much.
Right.
And that that causes, deeper divots and inconsistency with where the club hits the ground. On these little golf shots, I'd like to have people try to bruise the turf without taking more than about a half-dollar-sized divot. And it'd be real good practice to simply – Just turn around and hit it away from the green for, okay, don't kill anybody, but turn around and hit it to nowhere for a minute and just see how many times in a row can you hit that golf ball and bruise the turf rather than taking a big gouge. Now, that also means you can't miss the turf either, okay? And learn that feel. Like, you got to have soft arms. You can't get rigid, you know, but you shouldn't be getting flippy either. You want to have a somewhat relaxed approach to the shot, which will only be encouraged when you can control the depth of the divot. So just practicing back and forth, just trying to bounce the club, then hitting the golf shots, bounce every time without taking a divot. Yes, you are going to struggle. Sorry. It's going to happen.
Yeah.
But, you know, you learn how to walk by falling down. So why should this be any different?
Exactly.
Well, and something else, too, you know, guys, you talked about, you know, particularly in close around the green, you're chipping and things like that. You know, a common mistake, and we talked about this last week on Coach's Corner, it was brought up in one of the questions. Excuse me. You know, a lot of amateurs particularly, especially the high handicappers, make a mistake when they're chipping of being too far away from the ball. And a lot of times they don't, you know, they need to play that ball a little bit closer, and shorten up on that grip just a little bit, because I think a lot of times, as you said earlier, you know, when they're coming down into that ball, you know, whether it's a short chip or even a short pitch shot, they're coming in sometimes too steep and taking that big divot. So you want to, as you said, John, you know, you want to bruise the grass. You want to just really just take a very small, you know, half dollar size divot and not be moving heaven and earth in order to make contact with that ball, because it's not necessary, especially on the shorter shots, to have to do that. And I think that's a common mistake with a lot of, especially the high handicappers, is that ball is too far away sometimes, and of course they've got a full length grip, you know, on their club, and they're not really able to make consistent shots. And also too, especially on the chip shots, you want to be, you know, favoring a little bit more on your left side, your left foot, and you want to have that club shaft leaning forward just a little bit as well to make sure that you are making your downward contact and you're not hitting in behind the ball. So some great, great tips. Anything else, guys, that you want to add on for Rick out in San Diego to help him with a short game?
Yeah, I'll add just a couple more things. You know, first off, where is the ball going to land and how is it going to roll to the hole? So in little chip shots or even little pitch shots, we have really two targets. Where am I going to land this ball? And then where, how is it going to get to the targets from that point, the hole, meaning that I'm now reading it as a putt. So I'm going to land it here, and then I'm going to watch this thing roll as I would read it as a putt. So you're not trying to, you know, so you've got your two targets there. And then you've got your three different wedges, four different wedges if you're smart. You've got your wedges, and you've got your 8-iron, you've got your 9-iron, you've got your pitching wedge, and put some balls there and say, I'm going to go to this one spot here, and I'm going to hit five balls there. And then I've got a spot over there that I've put a circle or a target that's maybe, you know, six more yards. And then I've got another spot that's over there that's maybe three more yards. And I'm going to take these clubs and I'm going to take, see what happens when I use my sand wedge and I do like a 7:30 swing where my left arm goes to about 7:30 on a clock and swing through. And then I'm going to see what happens when I use my 9-iron to do that. And then what happens when I use my 7-iron to do that. And then you've all of a sudden got three different shots, three different lengths, three different rolls, three different trajectories of the ball, and you've got one basic swing but three different clubs, and you've got yourself, you know, three different shots there. So controlling your trajectory and then take a look and see what happens if I put the ball more forward in my stance. What happens if I have it in the middle? What happens if I have it in the back? What happens if I bring that handle and I lean that handle forward as I go through? What happens if I pull that handle up a little bit towards the middle of me? And then see what that does to my loft. What happens when I do that in the back of my stance? What happens when I do that in the front? All these little things, just getting awareness of how you can control your body and how you control that loft of that club is going to make a gigantic improvement in your short game.
Excellent point. John, is there anything else you want to add to that?
You know, I would add just one thing. If you're really feeling anxious at first, you are probably better off with the golf ball center or a little farther back in the stance, just to give yourself a better chance of hitting a golf ball first contact. As you get feeling more confident, then go ahead. You can, you know, my ball location can get all the way up to my front big toe. I've been known to hit it even farther forward than that. So, you know, it's as your skill improves, you can try more interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Lloyd, you raised a great point. Really, and this goes back really for all of our participants tonight that have sent us in some questions. You really need to, when you're at the range, separate from your play, you need to work on a lot of these different things. You need to experiment a little bit and see what happens, as you said, moving the ball up, moving it back, playing the club a little more, you know, maybe upright or moving it a little bit, you know, the handle a little bit forward. And you need to experiment with these different shots, and you need to, you know, use different clubs and do that. And a lot of times I think a lot of these common errors that we hear about in the business all the time could be eliminated if people – I think the number one thing is people need to listen, you know, when they're with their instructors and with their coaches. They need to really listen to what it is that we're trying to explain to you by doing these different little drills. It's not just a matter of – I think a lot of times – and I think Tom Patry, who was on the show a few weeks ago, had mentioned this – is it's great that you know, we all want somebody to come and take lessons and things like that, but the important thing is it doesn't end at the end of the lesson. The lesson continues until the next lesson. And that by that I mean you need to go out to the range or to the practice facility, and you need to practice what you've been taught in this particular session here. You need to work on those drills and those fundamentals that you've been taught, and focus on that, because if you're not going to do that, then all of the things that you're being told and you're hearing tonight are not going to benefit you to their fullest if you're not putting them into practice. So it's not just a matter of going for a lesson and thinking, okay, I'm cured. No, you have to work at it in between each of your sessions. And the pros do it. That's why they're playing on the PGA and the LPGA and the Champions Tour, because they work on these different things between the sessions that they have with their coaches. So anything that you want to add, either one of you, onto that, onto Rick and the short game?
I call that
or
taking the lesson with you.
Yeah, and I mean, it's being engaged in your practice. Allow your mind to be engaged in the practice. Enjoy what you're doing. You know, don't be so ball-oriented, all that stuff. You know, control that club, control that face of the club, and just enjoy where you're at. You know, there's that old saying sometimes, it's these guys that go out there and they shoot 110 and they're all mad and they're throwing the club down and all that, and, you know, you sit there and you look at the dude and you say, hey, guy, you're not good enough to be mad. And I tell my students, this all the time. I said, you're at the point of where you are. You accept where you are. Go forward. Be happy. Engage yourself into the practice that you're doing. And all learning comes from frustration. If it was easy, right, and if you're only going to practice the things that are easy for you, you're not going to get better. Practice the things that are hard for you, like Hogan, and keep working it. Be engaged in it. Be aware of what you're doing and enjoy it.
You know, I would add, with the short game stuff, I would add, please finish the hole out.
Yes.
Don't just chip. No. Don't just practice chipping. Play with my students, especially the kids groups. We constantly are playing a game called 21, where I'll set up 9 holes. They'll help me set up where they want the tees, so to speak, around the we have a really at White Manor. We have a outrageous short game area. It's amazing, and we'll set up 9 holes, and they have to play 4 score. So one of the things, you know, especially in the kids groups, they are constantly playing for scores. They're not just chipping and chipping and chipping, but they're chipping with a little something on the line all the time. So that will lead to a better transfer practice. It'll come with you to the golf course better if you put something on it like that in practice.
Yeah, we call it with my high school teams, we call it the up and down game, where we got 9 holes around our practice area, and we say, okay, I'll start it off, and I'll put a ball over into the rough over there, and I said, okay, we're going to go from that spot to that hole there. Here's your scorecard. I said, divide them up into teams, and they keep track of how many scores. Now you're playing 8 holes. You're playing 9 holes. We want to get this up and down, you know, obviously in 2 it would be the greatest thing. So 18 is the great score. You know, anything under 18, I'm hanging around with you, and we're going on tour later on.
Yeah,
you know,
in our case, we're playing 21, so that's the score to beat. That means they've gotten up and down six out of nine times.
21 is hard. I don't think I've ever even gotten an 18 yet. But but then the guy who wins that hole, he picks the next spot, and he picks where we're shipping from or pitching from and what hole we're going to. And then we do that. And every day that they do that, in my 2-week summer camps when I do that with these kids, you know, I'll take a look at your scorecard on the first day, and now let's do it the last week. And we always end every session. We do our driving and, our range sessions. Then we end it with that 9-hole thing. And then the last day, you take a look at their scorecards, and you see gigantic improvements in 2 weeks.
Well, sure. And you know, just to add to that, you know, and really what I was saying is, and I think everybody that's in the business understands this, in the teaching end of it particularly, is if you're not going to put these things into practice, you're never going to see improvement. And those are some great things to do in your camps and in your teaching philosophy. Is you've got to make it interesting, number one, but you've got to make it a challenging. If there's no challenge, one of the things, if I was to have a criticism in today's thought process with the average golfer, is they're looking for this, you know, much like they used to for the get-rich-quick scheme, they're looking for the quick fix for their golf game, and it doesn't exist. You're never going to have a quick fix, And unless they come out with technology and we all become bionic and are able to do things perfect. But the average person out there needs to understand that if they're not going to utilize their time more efficiently, and if you're going to go through the trouble of taking lessons, then you need to follow it up and get out there and work on some of those things, because
right.
otherwise it's never going to change. And that's what I think a lot of the problem is. They want to cram everything in, and you know, they're looking for a quick fix, and it's just not going to happen that way. Lloyd, as you mentioned earlier on there, is they've got to get out and work at it. And the best way to do that is to make it fun, but at the same time make it challenging. Give yourself, you know, set yourself up with some challenges and try to overcome that, because then when you do, you're going to feel that much more reward when you overcome
right.
some of those challenges. And when they become too easy, then you make them a little bit more difficult and keep pushing yourself a little bit more. And that, I guarantee you, that's how the pros do it, is they push themselves and they challenge themselves. They're not there just, you know, with their coach or their swing gurus and getting a pointer or you know, a tip here and there, and then saying, okay, well, I'm going to go out and play in the Masters next week and expect mm-hmm. they're going to win. No, they're going to go out there and they're going to work on those things that they have to work on. And that's how they
yep.
get to the level that they are. So great points, guys. We're going to follow up with one final question here, and this is a little bit different. It's not a technical question as far as how to play the game. But Lonnie from Dallas, Texas,
hey, Ted,
wrote in and
Ted,
he said, good evening. Yes?
Can I interrupt you real
yep.
quick about that? Because
yep.
you brought up a very important point is the challenge. So it's called the skills/challenge balance. When you set a goal for, say, the 21 game where you're going to do the up and downs, okay?
Right.
And your normal score is 4 from each of these spots, and you put your goal as 21,
mm-hmm.
you're in for a world of hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And the challenge
yeah.
is too far out of your reach, and that's
right.
going to lead to too much
yeah.
frustration. But let's say that you're a guy whose average score is 3 from all these spots around the green.
Right.
And we so okay, here's what you've got to do. You've got to come up and make 2 of these up and downs. Okay, so that would be 20. You have to shoot 25 this time, or you have to do it again, or you owe me $1, something like that.
Right.
So you if you can just manage the skills challenge balance real well. I mean, I've had PGA Tour players say, the thing is, I can't believe how you can keep me engaged this fully for 3 straight hours. Well, it's because
right.
I'm managing
yep.
that balance the entire time.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's really what it is learning to manage their time and learning to challenge themselves. And this is the thing is, you know, today's golfer, and we understand this in the business that, you know, time restrictions are very tough right now with a lot of people. Some people are out there with 2 jobs. It's very difficult to squeeze that time in. But I promise you, if you somehow micromanage that time and allow yourself some additional time, not only to take the lessons, but to allow you some additional time to get out and work on some of these things and challenge yourself, as we've discussed, I promise, all of us will promise you that you will improve vastly with your golf game. Great point, John, to end that segment. Let me just go into this last question. As I said, it's Lonnie from Dallas, Texas, and we're not going to help with his golf game. Instead, we're going to help with his equipment. And he starts off by saying, good evening. I'm wondering what the best way to go about getting some new clubs. I've been playing with the same clubs for many years, but feel it's time to upgrade. With all the options out there, I'm not sure what to look for or where to start. I'm currently a 20-plus handicap, if that helps. Do you have any recommendations for purchasing a new set of clubs? So let's look at this from a little more simplistic standpoint. Obviously, we want him to be fitted properly. We want him to consult with somebody that, you know, if he's taking lessons and things like that with his PGA professional to help guide him. But more importantly, there's some things that he's going to need to do first before he makes that change. So who wants to start it off?
Well, without knowing his age and where he's – and the reason I'm saying about the age is for a couple things. If he's a 20 handicap but going for lessons and is determined to bring his handicap down, and he's 20 years old, 22 years old, 23 years old, a young man, a young woman, then I might direct him in a different way than I would, say, somebody who's a 65, older gentleman,
sure.
older woman, who only plays once a week, you know, goes out with his buddies and plays that stuff. Well, then I'm pointing him in a different direction. You know, obviously with the help of a club fitter or somebody to fit him, you know, maybe he's going to be looking at more of, you know, graphite shafts and a lot of hybrids in his bag. You know, I hate to use game improvement because I'm not a big believer in what these, you know, club makers are.
Right.
Club designers and all that are telling us and all that. But, you know, little things like that. So obviously the most important thing is find somebody that you really, really know who knows his stuff, whether it's your instructor or whether it's a club fitter in your area. I don't know who's down and where he's at. You know, the Last
Texas.
Resort is one of the big box stores. Yeah, one of the big box stores. You know, that would be your last resort of going somewhere. I would do some research, send me an email. I'll look around. I'll talk to a couple guys. Me and Johnny know a couple guys that are on our golf forum groups that are big-time golf club makers, club forum people. Tom Wishin, Wishin Golf, is a great resource to go to. They can help you out with a lot of stuff over there. But, yeah, find somebody that you can trust to help you with picking out and getting you sized right, getting everything correct right here as far as shafts and, you know, the heads of the club.
Right. John, I'm going to flip this around a little bit and make it a little bit different for you to answer so that we're not sort of duplicating what Loy just said. What are some things that Lonnie is the gentleman from Dallas, Texas, what are some things that he should not do when he's going to purchase a new set of it? What are some things that he needs to guard against making mistakes?
Okay. thanks, Ted.
Yeah, I'm glad you got that one, Johnny.
All righty then. Don't go buy the damn things off the rack, Lonnie, for goodness sakes.
No.
Please don't do that. Next would be, you know, there are now two different shaft manufacturers, Nippon and I think KBS, that are making very quite lightweight steel shafts.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're in that range where you need lighter shafts, I would really encourage you to stay away from graphite.
Yep.
Unless you're going to get custom fit for graphite, because they, you know, generally speaking, what you get with graphite is very inconsistent relative to steel. You know, my driver shaft and my three wood and my hybrid shaft are $300 a piece, and you know, in my opinion, to make it a lighter version of steel, that's what it costs to make a shaft like that.
Yep.
So, you know, I'm not a real fan of a lot of these graphite shafts coming from major manufacturers. So I'd watch that. I would really pay attention to grip size, okay? And I would not what if you went out there and you got fit for clubs and those babies fit you beautifully? You weren't hitting the ball well, okay? So the guy who was fitting you did what we call a static fit, where you measured your arm length and all that good stuff, and that's what you need. Okay, check your swing speed and the way your shaft bends and all that good stuff, but you're hitting it like crap. Don't buy him. Go do it again. Do it again another pay. You know, I know you got to pay for it, but do it again, because if that happens and when those babies come in and if you don't hit them good right away, you're going to feel really bad. So if the fitting doesn't go well, do it again at another date when you're hitting it better. Better than that, you know, maybe, you know, be hitting it well before you get fit. That wouldn't stink either.
Yeah, exactly. And those are some great points. And the reason, you know, why I wanted to sort of throw that question in, it's a little bit different than the other questions, is, you know, I think a big mistake – two mistakes that I see happening all the time is, number one, you know, John, you pointed out, you know, don't buy it off the rack. You really do need to be – if you want it – now, if you're somebody that's playing once in a blue moon, you know, fine. You don't want to spend a lot of money. That's not a problem. But if you're somebody that's playing fairly regularly and it, you know, by the sounds of his email, you know, he's had these same clubs for many years. And I'm going to guess – he doesn't give his age here, but I'm going to guess he's probably 30s to 40s in that range. Again, Lloyd, you brought up a valid point. If he's a, you know, senior, a golfer, he may want to look at a different thing. Or if he's a junior golfer, again, you want to point him in a different direction. But we're going to go under the assumption that he's in his 30s, 40s. So he's, you know, he's played for a little while here. He's played with these same clubs. Number one, he needs to be fitted properly. And John, you raised a valid point. You want to make sure that, you know, you're hitting the ball fairly well. I mean, obviously he's a 20 handicapper, but, you know, he still hits a pretty decent ball. And then he wants to go and get fitted at that point. If he's not hitting the ball well, as you said, and he goes out and gets fitted and still not hitting the ball very well, he's not going to feel very good about his purchase or the decision he's just made. And more than likely, you're going to be finding him in the bottom of a pond somewhere at his local golf course.
Or worse, you know, maybe he'll find himself in the bottom of a pond.
Yeah.
Or he's going to go and beat that club pro over the head with his 5-iron, and we don't want that. It's a big decision, you know, for somebody that wants to play, you know, a fair amount of golf to make a purse. It's not something that should be taken lightly, and there are a lot of factors involved. And I think that, you know, consumers are certainly much more savvy, and certainly do your research ahead of time. Don't be one of these know-it-alls that come in and says, "Well, I've been reading on this and on this link over here and on that website, and they're telling me, you know, this I need this flex and that flex." No. That's what the professional's there for. Let them guide you. Certainly you want to provide some information, but you're there really to receive what it is that individual, their knowledge and their experience is going to help guide you in the right direction, because you want to make sure that you are fitted properly, because you're going to get the best overall result if you're fitted properly.
Yep.
Any final thoughts on that question, guys? And then I'm going to wrap this Coach's Corner up tonight and let you guys have a moment or two each to do a plug. So any final thoughts for Lonnie out in Texas?
No, I think we covered it. That's pretty good.
Yeah, don't be afraid to I have not sold a regular set of golf clubs in years. You know, you don't be talked into having to buy a 3-iron or even a 4-iron. At this point, as I'm getting older, my 4-iron has been replaced by a 4-hybrid or rescue club.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can custom order a set of golf clubs to be whatever you want. And I think that's people need to know that that's available. I'm not sure everybody knows that it is. You know what? One other thing. In 4 years, I have ordered one driver at full length. All the rest have been cut up to 2 or 3 inches.
Yeah.
Because people can't hit the sweet spot, and they're making the drivers longer and longer, so they get to claim that, well, if you could possibly still hit the sweet spot, this one's going to go farther. But then, of course, if you get farther away from the golf ball, your chance of hitting the sweet spot are worse.
Right.
So that's the other thing is, you know, 46 inches is entirely too long for a driver.
Yeah, 45 inches, like 20 handicapper is too long.
Right.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, obviously, you know, everybody's still in this distance mode, you know, wanting, you know, this is the direction that manufacturers, I think we all know this, the direction that manufacturers have been pushing for years is get more distance. So, of course, they're lengthening the shafts, and everybody's spraying further right and left than they have in many years. And the reason is they're playing with clubs that are not properly fit, and especially in the driver.
Right.
So some great points, guys. I want to thank you for coming on Coach's Corner tonight. I'm going to give you just a moment or two each before we close off this segment, and I've got the other gentleman that's going to be coming on here in just a few moments before he joins me. Lloyd, I'm going to let you start off this evening. Just to some final thoughts. Let people know how they can get a hold of you, and go ahead.
Well, the final thoughts are just enjoy the journey. Enjoy the journey in your practice and be engaged in your practice. And don't get so upset about it if you're not doing it the first day. It's supposed to be hard. So that's my final thoughts on that. As far as getting a hold of me, I'm in Florida right now until I'll be back in Chicago April 10th. ChicagolandGolfAcademy.com is a place if you want to book a lesson. My website is down for a redesign, but that will be up shortly. But until then, you can also email me at Lloyd, L-L-O-Y-D, Higley, H-I-G-L-E-Y, @gmail.com. If you have any questions on some of the stuff we talked about, I'd be glad to help you out. Send me an email, and I'll be glad to help you with that.
Appreciate it. John, final thoughts, and how can the folks get a hold of you if they want?
Okay. Well, keep practicing, folks. You'll have more fun. When you're doing practice, always start with what do you want the club to do to the ball better. Don't start with what you want to do with your body better. Okay? Start with what's really acting, and you'll be surprised to see that your body starts to move better when you focus on what you want to do with the club. Excuse me. Let's see. My website is johndunigan.com, or you can do Dunigan is D-U-N-I-G-A-N. John Dunigan Golf Works also. I have, if you go to my website, I have got a couple of, I've got a blog. I've also got down the homepage a little ways. You can, they're free downloads. Just click on it. You don't have to even, because I'm a real slacker. You don't really have to even sign up for the website or anything. You just download the darn things. They are Get to Know Golf, which is understanding the cause and effect of ball flight with a couple of drills to help with the essential skills. And then I have a ball flight test and a ball flight answer key. And I'm trying to get people to really understand why the ball goes where it goes. I also have books and DVDs. The DVDs, it's actually working now, believe it or not. You can actually download them right from my website. And the books, this stuff is sold all over the world. So, there's a lot of information on there that you can, I'm certain, use well. And I've got, 30 drills and other stuff on YouTube.
Very good. Gentlemen, I want to thank you for participating in Coach's Corner tonight. I hope you guys enjoyed help the listeners out there, and I know that they've got some good advice from both of you, and I look forward to having you guys come back on the program again anytime. And I know that, Lloyd, I think you're on for a few more segments of Coach's Corner throughout the year, so appreciate that. And, John, take a look at the schedule, and if you can come back on and help some of these guys out, I certainly appreciate your input as well. And as I said, you guys are welcome to come on anytime if you've got something that you want to share with the listeners, and maybe a new book or CD that's coming out, or just some golf talk in general. You're welcome to come back anytime. I appreciate it, guys.
Yep. Thank you.
Thanks,
Ted.
Hey, Johnny, nice talking to you again, buddy. I'll talk to you later.
All right, Lloyd. Hopefully we see each other soon. Take care.
Yeah, we will. Bye.
All right. Good night, guys. Thanks.
Good night.
Okay, just to quick wrap up here on the Coach's Corner segment, of course, my special guest panelist tonight was Lloyd Higley, PGA teaching professional at the Chicagoland Golf Academy. And his website is www.chicagolandgolfacademy.com. And, of course, PGA Master Teaching Professional John Dunigan was also here from the John Dunigan Golf Academy. And you can reach him, as he said, on johndunigan.com or johndunigangolf.com. Thanks, guys, for helping out. My next guest, I'm going to bring him out here. We're just running a minute or two behind. My next guest is the founder of really two golf schools, the Nationwide Golf Schools and the newly Golf School for Women, Mr. Bruce Baird. And I'm going to bring him out here, and we're going to talk a little golf as we do here on Golf Talk Live. Good evening, Bruce. Welcome to Golf Talk Live. Sorry to keep you waiting.
Yes, not at all. Am I on there with you, Ted?
You're certainly live on Golf Talk Live. Welcome to the program. I've already introduced
you,
and I'm glad to have
the opportunity.
That's my pleasure. Bruce, I just very briefly did an introduction. We just wrapped up the other segment here, and it indicated to the listeners here that you founded really two golf schools, the Nationwide Golf School and, of course, the newly launched National Golf School for Women. Tell us a little bit about, before we get into those, a little bit about your background and how you came to start two golf schools.
Well, I've been playing golf for almost 60 years, so that's a little bit about the history. I don't remember Ted Varden, but close. But and I've never been a professional player. I've been a good amateur, as I say, as long as I didn't get more than 200 miles from home. I've always been a student of the game, and I've self-taught. And like a lot of club players, I gave tips to lesser players along the line, as if I knew something. But in my 40s, my business was such that I could really devote a lot of time to golf, both playing and, of all things, practicing. And so I did that 300 to 400 strokes a day was the regimen, and that was fun, and I could still run my business. The weapon of choice is something that only old-timers remember, an R90 52-degree pitching wedge. That, and I only bring that up because I'm pleased to say without knowing it, without realizing it, and without hearing it, I really dug my swing out of the dirt. Hogan really would have been pleased. Well, without my knowing it, this golfing episode, which took place over a couple of years, planted the seeds for the establishment of my current golf schools. That, I have a name for it now. It's called Baird's Way. And the secret, in quotation marks, I pretend it's a secret, is that the golf swing is best learned from the green out, not the tee in. And most
right.
golf is taught today, however, and all you got to do is look at the driving range. It's taught from the tee back to the green. That's
right.
I might point out that this secret is not new. A fellow by the name of Ted Varden, over 100 years ago, recommended that as a way to learn the swing. Bobby Clampett, student of Ben Doyle up in Carmel, California, has come to the realization at the end of his career, or really his effective career, that he really should have focused more on the short swing. Now, this is not the same as the golf, the short game. Well, actually, so I brought this concept to the golf school, and this was 20 years ago, and it was definitely not in golf schools, it's still not used very much. The full swing is what the accent is on, and more appropriately, the players, they want to hit drivers. Well, you can't hit a good driver if you can't hit a good 9-iron. That's almost it's a given in golf. So I started the first school with this in mind, at 1995 at Pebble Beach, and that's and now we've expanded the nationwide golf schools to include six locations. So we have three in California, one in Nevada, one in Palm Springs, actually, that's part of California, and Nevada, and we also have one in Myrtle Beach. So that was the original school. That's and from that, I've segued into basically a new program with older students, and this has to do with the National Golf School for Women. So, and after a bit, I can talk a little bit about why we came to that. But at any rate, that's kind of what we've done. We've been doing it for 20 years. We're still a survivor. I think what we do is very, very good. I've had some recognition for it. I certainly don't represent that. As a teacher, I don't represent I know everything. And as a good teacher,
no.
I represent that I probably have a long way to learn, even after over 50 years in the game. So not 50 years of teaching, obviously.
Right.
So that's kind of where we started.
Right. What would you think, if just to sort of summarize, what would you classify or categorize your teaching philosophy?
I used to be a school teacher, okay? That was a long time ago. That was my first career. And one thing I discovered when I walked into the classroom the first time, that every one of those people sitting in front of me was different. Some were smarter, some were big, some were heavier, some were not so smart, some were girls, some were boys. And I was 22 years old when I walked into that classroom. And I thought everybody in the world was like me. You know, that's you stand one day in a classroom and you realize that nobody is like you. They're all different.
Right.
So it took me about a month, I would say, to discover that I had to be able to discern and determine what each student was capable of. And those were in the old days, you know, when you didn't have a lot of testing to determine exactly what kind of level they're at. So every person is different. When I went into teaching golf, I started with the same attitude. If you're built like a linebacker, or if you're built like a ballerina, or if you're built like any one of your golfers are built like Arnold Palmer, you swing differently than Freddie Couples. If that's
right.
so, then you have to treat each person different. You have to find out what they are. Now, that's not easy sometimes. We actually use a questionnaire before they come to the school to see what they think they are. Because a lot of people think they're one thing, and they're actually quite something different.
Yep.
So the first part of the teaching philosophy would be very simple. I need to know what they are and what differences there are in their makeup, both physical and mental. And then the second thing, and I believe this is terribly important because it isn't characteristic of most teaching, I believe in teaching to their strength first, their weaknesses second. And there's more than just a little subtlety there, because you can discourage people. All you have to do is tell them that golf is more difficult than brain surgery. It's not, or it doesn't have to be. And just as that classroom that I used to teach in, that the level of confidence that you give a student, whether he's got a golf club or whether he's got a slide rule, there aren't any more slide rules, I'm sorry about that. You've got to teach to their strength in order to give them some confidence in order to move into their weaknesses. I do believe that an awful lot of teaching, both in golf and probably every place else out there, dwells on the negative first and the positive second. I believe that is destructive. So even if I have a beginner, an absolute novice, I can still find, if I'm going to be looking for it, some kind of strength that they have that I can build on, and that's where we start. So those two things are probably the biggest things that would be my teaching philosophy. And then the trick is to learn quickly what kind of person they are and what their strengths are. If you're talking to a lawyer and a ballerina in the same class, or ballet master, I've actually had that. I've had a lawyer and a ballet master in the same class that I'm teaching. And let me tell you, those are two different learning types.
Sure.
The lawyer wants to talk about it, and the ballet master says, show me. And you've got to be able to do that in order to be effective.
Yeah, and that's true because, you know, as an example, it really comes to different learning styles. Like, for instance, myself, I'm more of a visual person. I need to see certain things, and that doesn't mean you can't, you know, over time, obviously, you develop the other, but through years of experience. But I'm more of a visual. I've always, you know, been able to receive whatever messages that are coming my way through visual stimulation. Let me read something that I actually pulled off your website that I think really sort of sums up what you're saying here, and it's really part of your California Golf School mission. And I'll just read it here quickly, and then we'll continue on. At Bruce Barrett's California Golf Schools, we dedicate ourselves to the idea that every golfer must develop his or her own golf game. Just as a writer or musician must have a personal style, in our experience, we have found ample evidence that any golfer's game can be seriously disrupted by attempting to copy someone else's style, grip, stance, or swing. So that really sort of encapsulates what you were trying to say is, everybody is different, whether it's a lawyer or a ballerina. Everybody is different. Their learning is different, and their physical being is different. So they have to be approached differently. And I think sometimes in the past, the industry has tried to standardize its teaching, sort of a one-size-fits-all. And I think as time goes on, much like you indicated a moment ago, the old school of thought was to teach from the tee to the green, and really a lot of people are starting to understand now that it really should be from the green back to the tee that we should be teaching.
Right, and one of the reasons, and there's more than just a logic to it. And by the way, I did write that quotation you had there probably 20 years ago. So when I started the school, so I haven't changed it because I still believe it works in the first place. That. Mm-hmm. You are very familiar, I'm sure, with the theory that you're supposed to have the same swing with the driver in your hand as with the 9-iron in your hand. Supposed to be the same swing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the driver might be moving, average golfer, maybe he's moving 85 miles an hour. The 9-iron in the hand for the average driver is probably moving 60 miles an hour. I would suggest that if you are trying to learn something, like how to get the club down to the ball, that it is easier for you to do that if the club head is moving at 60 miles an hour than it is if it's moving at 85. And if that's
right.
true, then you can develop your confidence faster, because I can take anybody with reasonable kind of physical activity, put them 10 feet off the green, you know, 10 feet, and I can show them something about a fundamental of golf, if nothing more than grip tension, which when you hit a driver, as you well know, you start hitting drivers, the tension builds because the club is moving faster, the muscles are moving faster, and you talk faster, and you hit faster. So the
yep.
idea that you would learn the golf swing, that's kind of why I call it Baird's Way. It's not the golf, it's not Dave Pelz's short game. It's the short swing, which leads eventually, if you will, to the full swing. And I think you can learn, I know you can, learn the full swing faster by starting from the green than you can if you start even with a 7-iron in your hand. That builds confidence. You know, you actually get the ball up in the air a little bit. My heavens.
Yeah. Let me just read a little bit more from your site here that I copied down, and you talked about Baird's Way. Let me just read this out to the listeners, because I think this is important. And again, it sort of rolls into what we're talking about right here. Bruce Baird is regarded as one of America's finest golf teacher professionals. As a golf instructor, he is known for successfully adapting his golf teaching approach to each individual's abilities and needs. He and his team of professional golf teaching coaches help people find their natural golf swing using a unique golf instruction short swing teaching technique Bruce developed over 17 years ago. Bruce believes that each of us has a unique combination of body type, rhythm, and coordination that produces the natural tendencies we use when swinging a golf club. Most golf teaching professionals teach fundamentals, which are important, but Bruce believes these golfing fundamentals must be adapted to fit the natural tendencies present in each individual student. This approach forms the basis of the nationwide golf instruction method, an approach that makes our golf teaching professionals the most successful choice for any golfer. And the reason I wanted to read that is within the body of that text really sums up what you've been talking about here, and that is really it's great to teach the fundamentals, but everybody, because they are different, people have to find what might work for me may not work for you, and vice versa. And I think that as an instructor, we have to be conscious of that, and I think a lot of them are, but I think there are still, you know, as you said, some out there that are not, you know, sort of trying to one size fits all, and that's not going to work, especially with today's golfer. You want to continue on with your
right, and the other reason, and I've had to, I've brought up a number of young golfers to teach with me, but primarily because I'm older and my marketplace is older people. I've had to be careful about the instructors I hire, and a lot of them are a lot smarter than I am. I mean, there's plenty of, I don't pretend to be, I'm good at what I do. I don't pretend to be on the same level with people. I would not want to try to teach a professional. I could show him something, but I wouldn't want to teach him, because that's a whole different world. But I've had to make my instructors see this is more effective, especially if you're on the lower level, if you're in the novice or the average golfer. Average golfer, you know, he shoots 90. He doesn't have a golf swing. That's why he shoots 90. Okay.
Yep.
And the whole drill is, if you want to improve, if that's part of your goal, if you want to keep it in the fairway, you've got to have a better consistent swing. And so, but the public, because of hype, because of Callaway, because of distance, because of everything else, they don't want, as a general rule, they want to hit the driver. All you got to do is go to the driving range and see how many people are practicing with a 9-iron as opposed to those who are practicing with the driver. It's all wrong from that point of view. When I was hitting 300 and 400 balls a day, it was with a pitching wedge only. I don't think I ever hit 100 balls in a week with the driver because I couldn't learn anything there. I couldn't learn anything there until I got a better swing. And I went from a probably a pretty good four handicap, to a scratch after probably about 8 months. And I had a swing that I didn't even recognize from my old one because I had better tempo, better timing. That is hard to take an instructor, especially someone who's experienced and who is used to getting the guy with the driver in his hand. Certainly at the end of a couple of hours, he's hitting a full swing. And I would suggest, and instructors, because that isn't the way they're taught. That isn't the way they were taught. And most of them were not public school teachers. They don't necessarily see the individual person. Now, if you're a salesman, you know that, okay? You can't treat a lawyer as a salesman the same as you would a farmer. You've got to communicate, in other words. So it's a learning process, and I got news. I didn't have it all the first year. I got plenty of news on that because I have a number of stories where my ignorance of the very thing I'm talking about, which I should have known more than anybody else, where I tried to make one size fit all without realizing it. It's a process. You know, that's all. That's the fun part.
Yeah. Do you have some special techniques that you like to use at the schools?
It's probably consistent with what we've just talked about. I could probably describe the first, the first half hour of a 3 day school, because typically schools are 3 days. They're 5 hours a day, you're not slugging balls all that time. You do get into but you'll make a lot of motions. It's not a boot camp, but it's definitely over a period of 3 days you'll make probably about 800 swings at a ball. Probably maybe 20 of that might be with a driver or even a hybrid. So first hour, I suppose, once we've determined that you do have a grip, alignment, stance, and posture. Once you've decided that your static fundamentals are adequate, they're suited to your stature. And you've got to do that because somebody who's my brother's 6'4", and he has, and he plays good golf still, but he's got terrible posture, and because he's 6'4", and he never tried. He never tried to really get longer clubs or to deal with it. He just stayed with what he's got the same swing now that he had 40 years ago. Only he's a better golfer because he plays more and practices. So posture is important. Alignment, just being able to know that you are properly aligned, that's important. And certainly a grip. If you've got a crazy grip, you're asking for trouble. Okay. So grip, alignment, stance, and posture, that's what we call the static fundamentals. Then we'll grab a pitching wedge, or probably won't take a pitching wedge, probably take an 8-iron. And we'll start about 10 to 15 feet off the green, depending upon what your skill level is. If you're a single-digit player, I'm probably going to start you about 10 yards out there. But it's not going to be 10 feet. It'll probably be 10 yards because you're a little more advanced.
Right.
Well, the idea is, what can I do from 10 feet? I'm not trying to get it closer to the hole. I'm trying to see that your grip stays proper. I'm trying to see that you move your upper body in the proper fashion. You don't break the wrist, for example, that type of thing. And I want to see that you move the club in a downward angle so you get the ball up in the air a little bit. That's not a lot, just a little bit. And we're going to work on that. And certainly if it's a novice, you're going to work on that for probably an hour or more. You're going to work on it until they're going to have some success before you move out to 20 feet or 30 feet. So the process really is moving out over a period, let's say, of the first day. I tell students before they ever come and when they're here that if you're probably not going to hit a full shot until the end of the first day, depending upon what your skill level is. That wouldn't be so for a handicapper, but it would certainly be so for an amateur, because I'm trying to change some things. And if they don't want to change things, they shouldn't come to school. Because if they had it all, then they don't need to come to school. I mean, I have a lot of students who just barely break 90. They did once in a while, and they think, well, you know, if you only give me a couple of ideas, if I can keep my driver in the fairway, I know I could be down in the low 80s. And, you know, okay, if you want to pay me $1,000 to tell me that that's true, that's fine, but it won't work. So,
And we talked about that actually on the segment before you came on, Coach's Corner.
Right.
We talked a little bit about that and you know how you know a lot of people in their mindset they want these quick fixes and that, you know, if you could just give me a couple of pointers here, but then they don't want to actually they don't want to put it into practice. You know, they want to get the lesson and they figure, okay, now I'm cured. You know, the shanks are going away or the slice is going to go away, and that just doesn't happen like that. They have to be able to put those thoughts and that process to work, and they need to practice it. And it's something that, you know, it's the best players in the world practice those, everything from the static fundamentals to, you know, Nicholas did that for years. I mean, he talked about that every time, you know, when he would start a new season, he went back to those static fundamentals every year, and he went through them, you know, from back to front to back. Every year before he went out and played. And that was because he wanted to, you know, make sure that he understood that he was doing everything correctly and it was working in the proper fashion. And that was why he was as successful as he was. Bruce, let me ask you, because there are some things in the golf business, and I want to give you obviously an opportunity in a little bit to talk about something new that you've been working on. But give us a little bit of an idea of what your business philosophy is.
Business. Well, it happened that I know what it is. That's, I had the distinct pleasure, and I have to pat myself on the back a little bit. The late Pat Summerall had a program back some years ago on Fox News, and it was Business Successes. And he actually contacted me about coming on. So I've actually had my 15 minutes of fame, like Andy Warhol. I was on national television on Fox News with Pat Summerall while he was alive. I was, and to my knowledge, it was the only golf school that he picked. And the reason he picked me was not because I had a big name, because that's not the case.
Right.
I'm not Butch Harmon or any of the big boys. My philosophy of business was, I only do what I love to do. Mm-hmm. I try to do it as good as I can, and then I improve on it. And I'm still working on improving after 20 years in this golf business. I'm still working on improving what I started 20 years ago. That's pretty much my philosophy. Mostly I don't do anything I don't like, not very long.
Well, and you know, something, too, that I've talked about in this program as well, and you know, obviously there's different teaching styles and things like that out there, and everybody has their own way of approaching things. But one of the things that I fear a little bit with the industry, and I've mentioned this very openly on this broadcast in the past, is, number one, the equipment. I think that there's too much focus on the driver. By the manufacturers, there's too much, you know, this grip it, rip it mentality. And yeah, it can be exciting to a point, but it's not helping the average golfer out there improve their game, because they're too busy trying to, you know, push it out those extra yards when really they should be focusing on the shorter shots and putting and things like that. And then the other thing as well, even on the teaching end, and I'm sure that some are out there going to disagree, I'm all for technology. I'm all for some of the latest advancements and stats and things like that. And you and I have talked privately a little bit about that in our calls. But I worry sometimes that too much emphasis is being focused sometimes on, you know, getting so many credentials and things. I put it in the same category as a doctor. I mean, when you look at a doctor's name on his card and he's got about 14,000 letters following his name, and each one meaning something different, And it's not to criticize, you know, my fellow teaching pro. I mean, I think it's important that we keep up to date and things like that. But I think sometimes there are just so many different techniques and things and ways of adding to the experience that there's too much focus on that. And what ends up happening is, yeah, you've got all these certifications and credentials and things like that. But are we going overboard and not sticking with sometimes the basics? And are people, because according to the stats, the average handicap still has not improved
the same as
in the last 20 years.
25 years ago. Yeah.
Exactly.
That,
so, you know,
yeah.
So, you know, is all of this technology and all of this, these advancements, how is it benefiting the game? I mean, it's certainly benefiting the instructors by giving them more knowledge, but how is it benefiting the students? And that's something that, that, you know, is a question for a later date. But I want to move into really the second segment of this, you know, this area, because it brings up a question that, that you have here, is, and that is, what is the state of the golf landscape, in your opinion?
Well, at the first place, it statistically is in a decline. We had over the numbers 4 or 5, probably 10 years ago. The numbers were 30 million people who were defined as golfers. Today, we have approximately 24 million people who are defined as golfers, and those are people who play. They define it as probably twice a month. That's a golfer. Well, you can. It's not twice a week, it's twice a month. It's in a decline. Now, there's no question about it. That and the reasons. Well, the economy, certainly the recession didn't help the thing. The expense.
Sure.
When you start talking about a $500 driver, that and the hype that goes with it, and the ego that goes with it, it's craziness. Even if you've got the money, it's craziness. You can't buy a golf swing. That's
no
expense. The time, we are certainly in a I'm an old guy in the scheme of things, and I don't have time, and I have a slower pace than certainly than my son, who's in his 50s. The time to do it is we have to. Actually, people are going to have to work more. The fact that the golf courses are overbuilt. I'm from California, and I saw at least in Monterey Peninsula at least 3 $30 million courses that were less than 10 years old that were sold for less than $5 million apiece. 3 times in the Monterey Peninsula. And while I was one of my golf schools is there. Too many golf courses, and that's a waste of money. And of course, they were all high end. Now most of them are no longer high end. Now they're semi-private, or public. So, and I think another thing, if I can just get me on the discourse here, the society we live in has changed immensely since since I grew up, and perhaps you too. Mm-hmm. We have become a spectator society and not a playing society. You know, we too many couch potatoes. They want to watch football. They want to watch basketball. Nothing wrong with that, but we don't get outdoors the way we used to. We sit there, and I can't imagine how much inactivity takes place during March Madness. So I think those things really have created a decline. And I really think the one thing is that seems to me, when I ponder that, that because it is such a conservative sport, it's a highly individualistic sport. It's not an easy sport by any means. It requires more of us than people want to give. When you talk about honesty, you talk about integrity, you talk about smelling the roses. Those aren't competitive things. Those are lifestyle things. Well, people don't have much of a lifestyle collectively anymore. You know, they've got a cell phone in their ear. And that affects golf and the people who run golf, the royal and ancient. That's what they are. They're royal and ancient.
Yeah.
And I don't think they're dealing with their own issues sometimes.
Right, and let me add, yeah, let me throw some more stats in there. We talked about this on the phone earlier today, yesterday, I guess it was. But just to sort of add to this very quickly, I did about 2 weeks ago on the program, two, maybe 3 weeks ago now, I talked about some articles that I had read, and I sort of summarized them all together on this very topic about the decline in golf. And, you know, taking those numbers that you had mentioned, you know, 24 to 30 million, you know, potential golfers out there or classified as golfers, since 2006, as an example, the number of rounds played by those golfers has decreased by 4.5 to 5% per year.
Didn't know that. Mm-hmm.
The two areas that really were the biggest culprits, number two, and I'm going to do them not in order of importance, but number two was, of course, financial. Now, 80% of those golfers, of those 24 to 30 million golfers out there that are currently playing, and I'm, of course, referring to the United States, 80% of those are playing on public courses, and the average cost of public courses is about $45. They've decided it's $45 per round. So it's, even though that with the recession thing, that is certainly a factor that's keeping people out, but the number one factor that they've discovered that's causing the decline is work, and that is people are so engaged with work, you know, having to make ends meet and working longer hours or working second jobs, that their leisure time that they would normally afford to play golf is no longer there or is greatly diminished. So as an example, you might have had a businessman or even, you know, we talked about a doctor here a second ago. Doctors might take Wednesday off or might take a Friday off or something like that and go out and play golf. They're not doing that anymore. They don't have the time. And as a result, all these courses that popped up, you know, in the last 20 years are scrambling to attract that, you know, that golfer that does want to play. And instead of maybe 24 million guys out playing every week, they might only be playing a couple times a month because that's all their time permits. And what's happened as a result is courses and instructors are discounting heavily both their facilities and lessons in order to try and draw this business in. And what they're really doing, it's not having the effect that they think, because that's why so many courses have gone out of business, because the discounting is not helping. It's not a matter of a cost factor so much as it is a time factor, and it's because people have prioritized what their time is.
That's right.
You know,
yeah, the society has changed, and I don't have and exactly what you say. We run faster in place. You know, we still have 24 hours, and we haven't paced it. The society doesn't allow us to pace ourselves, even if we're comfortable. It doesn't allow us to pace ourselves. It just keeps us like Alice in Wonderland. You know, we keep running faster and faster, and we get farther and farther behind. That's a societal thing too, and that affects everything. I mean, that affects our income, our lives, our marriages, and everything. So, and we have to deal with the change, and golf is one of those things that doesn't like to change very much.
And I know as a result of some of the declines that have happened in golf, I know that some of the top, you know, business people and so forth in golf, the same people that have been making the decisions, I know are trying to organize now ways of changing that. And what concerns me is because it's these same people that have been sort of throwing their hat in the ring, maybe it's time that we need some fresh ideas, and as opposed to everybody sort of discounting and you know, giving away the farm, so to speak, we need to start finding other ways to get people back in. And that's going to lead me in here in just a moment to an area that I know that you want to talk about, an area that's really very untapped in comparison. But before that, I want to ask you very quickly, Bruce, what are some of the positive aspects of the golf game and, of course, the business of golf? What are some positive things that you're seeing out there now that are going to help?
Well, the young end, because this has got to be something that's you're not going to teach us old guys committing new tricks. We're not going to take a PGA pro who's in his 50s and have him see what we're seeing. So it isn't us guys that have got to make the change. It's like everything else. You have to start down at the level, the lower level, and that's the students. Both of my kids were exposed to golf from the time I used to own a miniature golf course. That they were exposed to golf. Mm-hmm. One of them took to it, and the other one's an engineer. But the one who took to it, it's a lifetime thing. And he still plays, and he was, you know, he was beating me when he was 13 years old. That's when you want to start it. Well, the first tee, I'm sure you know about that. That's where you're disadvantaged and your lower income people. Certainly that's been triggered by the efforts of Tiger Woods, but not just him. And the first tee has spread, and in almost every community now, there's a first tee representative. That's a big deal. That brings in the kids who don't have the money in the first place. I was fortunate enough to be able to afford a private club. Most of the time. So you got to start there. The first tee is a big deal in my opinion. The other thing which we're going to segue into in a minute or two, and that is what the Executive Women's Golf Association is doing for golf. And not just not just the business end, but if there is, in my opinion, and I think you and I are probably alike on this, in my opinion, the people that are doing the most to save the game, and I mean the game, I'm not talking just about making money at it, is probably the women. The women, because golf has many subtle things to it. It's not all just a matter of competition. You know, it isn't a matter of beating up on somebody. It's a matter of coming to grips with yourself sometimes. You know, that's
right.
So I think they're a tremendous force. I think the women are probably, in my opinion, the women are probably the most dominant force in the economics of golf right now. That's a way out opinion, but that's one of the reasons why, economically, that I'm interested in being in that in the vanguard, because they are doing it on an organized, networking, systematic fashion. And quite honestly, and I have no problem with this opinion, I do not see the male business people looking at the game in the same way. And so those are the things. First, he and the women, I think, are the big deals. And I'm not sure I've got another better one.
Yep. No, you hit it right on the nail right on the head. And that leads us into really our final segue here is you're just launching now a national golf school for women. Tell us a little bit about that and how that came about, and then we'll tell them where they can get more information if they want to participate.
Sure. Yeah, with my other golf school, which was a typical golf school for 20 years, that 40% of my business came from women anyway, okay? Golf schools, the decision to come to golf schools invariably is either made by the woman or she's coming. She has to give her husband permission, to be able to go away for a weekend for a golf school, 3 days. So the women have always been in a substantial part. But the men are working harder now, longer, as you say. But the women are doing something, a statistic, one that I dearly love. From 2012, that women owned businesses, that's only 2 years ago, women owned businesses increased their average income from $95,000 a year to $110,000 a year. This was during the recession. Now, men who owned their own business did not have that kind of increase at all. The fastest growing share of the golf market is women. So being a reasonable businessman and having taught women for 20 years, and I enjoy the process because so much of, you ask me why, so many women are much better learners than men. They listen, not all of them, but they listen, and they actually, I won't say they're any easier to deal with, but they listen better. And especially if you're, if you know what you, they also can sense real quick, like whether you are on the point or not. So, I mean, it's a two-edged sword. But putting that aside, so I organized this program, which is two things, because these women are in business. The ones that I'm aiming for with the National Golf School for Women is the professional woman, or the C-level, the CEO-type woman, owns her own business.
Right.
Typically is independent in her own thinking, and who has a love of the game. Women do not compete the same way as some do, but most women do not just compete in their business life. They network. And women have discovered, and that's one reason why their income is going up, they have discovered clearly that golf is a great mechanism in which you can, if you will, to use the term, in which you can press against the glass ceiling. So that if you take the fastest growing market in the golf business, and it's the women, and if you take the fact mm-hmm. that the women are making, in one sense, they're making money faster than the ordinary business man, it's not too much of a stretch for me to see, gee, I really ought to be there. So that's why we set this thing together. And what it is, it's workshops. And but the workshops consist of two parts. One part is, if you will, how can the ladies learn to network better using the vehicle of golf, because that is so significant. But the other half is what I've been doing for 20 years. And that is teaching them how to play the game, understand the game, and love the game, other than just simply how you're going to make money at it. And for that,
right.
we have LPGA professionals. The people who present these workshops are people in the industry, if you will, women who have been there, done that. This is not a theoretical exercise. This is people who know what they're talking about, both in golf. They're not teaching golfers, and they don't have to be great golfers, but they've been there, done that. And so that's what we do. And our first program, since you've asked me, that is going mm-hmm. to be in outside of Atlanta. It's called the Chateau Elan Resort and Winery, and it's going to be a three-day program for this type of basically women who are already golfers, and who are already business people. And that will be 3 days down there. We are actually working on the customers right now. So, and then after that, I will when I'm talking about national, I haven't gone national yet, but I've got the organization set up for Myrtle Beach.
Right.
And also Sedona, Arizona, and San Diego. I've got people, they're not on salary, but I've got people waiting to do this as soon as we're ready to make an expansion, which will probably be. We'll see how this one goes to see how fast
right.
it expand. That's so.
And that's going to be May 18th through the 21st.
You're right. Actually, you come in on Sunday, and we'll be all done on Wednesday. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday is the real focus of it. And we'll have no more than a dozen people there. And if we have a dozen, we would have three instructors, because this is not going to be a clinic. This will be. Basically, what we'll do is the type of thing that you and I have been talking about as far as the school. It will mm-hmm. be a focus on getting better mechanics in your golf swing. So we're going to show you how to play better golf, and we're also going to show you how you can do it better with business. And by the way, I'd like to think I invented this, but actually when I looked around and saw how many women are doing this very thing, they're way ahead of us. This is a very, very. It's not just money. Business is one of the ladies I've met. She's writing a book, and she means mm-hmm. it. She's writing a book, and the name of the book is How Golf Saved My Life. Now, not too many men would have that as the title of their book, but she did, and
no.
it had to do with her illness. It had to do with her divorce. Mm-hmm. It had to do with her financial problems. And through golf and networking, by the way, because it might have been through golf and the people I met in golf could be saved her life. I think that's worth talking about. I think that's worth listening to, and that's kind of, in a nutshell, that's what we're doing.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, you and I, when we talked before, I mentioned to you that one of the things that I'm going to be doing with my program is starting a new program, separate from, of course, the Golf Talk Live program, starting on April 8th, Tuesday mornings. April 8th will be the first launch of it, and LBJ teacher professional Cindy Miller is going to be co-hosting that with me, and that's going to be on from 9 a.m. To 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. And that's one of the reasons, and some of the mutual people that are in the women's end of things are going to be involved as well. And that was one of the reasons, just like what you've summarized here in the last few minutes, is one of the reasons why I did that, is it's a huge untapped market. And a lot of people don't understand. They say, well, you know, we've got LPGA players and we've got, you know, women playing golf. We don't understand. What do you mean it's untapped? 50% or better of the global population are women, and yet in the teaching professional end, there are approximately, and I'm referring mainly here in the United States, there are approximately 1,200 in the teaching profession that are female, compared to, you know, well over 50, you know, 60,000 in the male side. Mm-hmm. So there's a big, you know, difference in stats there, and part of the reason is, in my estimation, is the industry itself has not very aggressively gone to welcome women into the golf world. They've had to sort of push their way through on their own.
Right.
And what I want to do with the program and you're doing with your National Golf Schools for Women is really to open those doors up and get more women involved. They understand the benefits. They don't have to be told what the benefits are. They know what the benefits are. They just want to be involved, and they want to be able to utilize that. So what you're doing with your schools and what I'm going to be doing with this program are going to help break that glass ceiling, if you will. And that, as you indicated earlier in your segment, that's what's going to help really save this game.
I think so. They have, as we both know, and anybody who's thought about it very long, the game has more going for it than the 10-foot putt. That's and that portion, if we lose that, then it's just like, you know, basketball doesn't have anything going for it except scoring baskets. You know, there's not the you're not engaged. You're physically engaged, but you're not. Your philosophy is not engaged in a basketball game or a baseball game or a football game. Those are different kinds of activities. And golf has the engagement quality that goes, what was it Ben Hogan said, a wonderful quote. He says, a perfect golf shot resonates from your wrist right up your forearm right into your heart. Now, that was Ben Hogan that said that. Now, that's a game worth preserving. And it certainly, and I think women bring a lot of class to that.
There's a whole another show that I could do that would be able to explain that. But Bruce, we just got a moment or two here. I want to give you an opportunity to let people know how they can get a hold of you and how they can get in touch and find more about that. And you've got a couple of websites. Let me just read them out here real quick, and then you can add a few thoughts to it as well. Your principal website, I know, is www.weteachgolf.com. That's how they can get a hold of you. And also for this new National Golf School for Women, it's www.nationalgolfschoolforwomen.com.
Correct.
If they want to participate in April, can they do so? For any of the ladies that are interested in participating May in Atlanta, they can do so through the website. Is that correct?
Yes, and that's correct. Yes, the website or my personal telephone. Since it's, I obviously would like to talk to people because it's not an inexpensive foray. So I'd like to talk to them about what they're going to get. But clearly, they can find out whether they are interested from the website. I made that website about as transparent as I can so that you can see whether it's your cup of tea right off the bat. And then In fact, my telephone number is 800-894-9593, and that's my personal cell, and I can always, I'm good at getting back to you, answer any questions you have, and deal with any issues that you might want to deal with. But we certainly encourage you to look around and see what we do.
Well, that is perfect. Bruce, I want to...
Could I get in a plug,
sure,
for a friend of mine, by the way? One thing that
you certainly
the women are finding out, the same as the men, that there ain't enough jobs out there. that's for everybody. But I have a young lady that I've talked to who will probably be coming to the school. She's a promoter. She's a salesperson. She was involved with PGA marketing and for a number of years, and I would like to make a plug for her just because I think she is looking for a job at this point in golf, and she'll be doing some work with me, but not enough to make it a career.
Sure.
Her name is Holly Stephen, Stephan, and anybody who's looking for a very competent person with all kinds of credentials, which I won't get into. This is a plug, not a story.
Right.
Give me a call, and I'll forward it on to Holly. But I told her I would do that because I think she deserves a little bit of help there. I think she's been a 10-year member of the EWGA, of the Executive Women, so she's definitely been around and knows what she's doing. Beyond that...
Well, I'll tell you what. Yeah, I'll tell you what, Bruce. You send me that information on her in an email at some point in the next few days, and I will make sure that I help network that out for her and see if we can help that young lady. I'm always glad to help anybody out in the business, and I take you on your word that she's a more than competent young lady and certainly going to be an asset to any golf business out there. So send me that information, if you will, Bruce, in an email, and I will help circulate that through my network as well.
Well, that's good. Well, I know she'll be thrilled at that, so we'll do that. Well, that's, I think, probably you've exhausted my knowledge. I could talk all night, but
yep.
I'm not sure I'd make any more sense, but that's another story.
No, I appreciate it. Bruce,
once a school teacher,
I appreciate coming
a school
on,
teacher.
I know. I appreciate you coming on Golf Talk Live, and I'm going to just take a moment or two myself and wrap up. But I want to thank you, Bruce, for coming on Golf Talk Live, and you have an open invitation to come back anytime you like. If you've got something new that you want to share with the listeners, by all means, you know how to get in touch with me, and we'll set something up. And I want to wish you much success with not only your current business ventures, but also this new one here in the National Golf School for Women. I will certainly what I'm going to do as well, Bruce, and we'll talk about this at a later point. But we've talked a little bit off air before, but I'm going to put some links and things like that on my website, backing it to yours, and particularly the National Golf School for Women, so that my listeners and audience that visit my website can have a chance to view yours as well with a direct link from mine. So we'll set that up in the next weeks to come, but I want to wish you much continued success, and I thank you for sharing your knowledge and your expertise and your experience with my listeners. I think they certainly will go away with being a better, not only professional, but a better golfer in the long run. And I want to thank you, and as I said, much continued success in your golf business.
Well, thank you. I consider it a privilege to know you, because I know that you're really doing some good work here. And those of us who have been at this game for almost 100 years, you know that thank you for what you do there. We thank you for your service.
Well, I appreciate
I'll
that,
I'll let
Bruce.
You go, my friend.
All right. Thank you, and we will talk soon. And again, I will... send me that information on Holly, and I'll be more than happy to circulate that through as well. Bruce Baird, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for your time, and we will talk to you very shortly, sir.
Thank you. Good night now.
All right. Okay, just have a quick moment here, and then I'm going to sign off for the evening. I want to thank my special guests, of course, on the Coach's Corner panel. I want to thank, of course, Lloyd Higley, PGA teacher professional at the Chicagoland Golf Academy, He's going to be heading up there in a few short weeks back up to Chicago. Lloyd, I hope you have your snow shovel ready. I think you're going to be digging yourself out a little bit up there from recent weeks. But thank you very much for your thoughts and input on Coach's Corner tonight. And, of course, PJ Master Teacher Professional, Mr. John Dunnigan, thank you for joining in the panel as well tonight. And you can get a hold of John at www.johndunnigan.com or johndunnigangolf.com. Either way, it'll come up. And also, Lloyd, you can get him on his website at www.chicagolandgolfacademy.com or lloydhigley@gmail.com. You can email him if you're interested in getting together with him for some lessons or just to learn a little bit more about golf. Two great gentlemen. Thank you guys for pitching in a Coach's Corner tonight, and look forward to having you guys back many, many, many times. And I want to thank my very special guest who closed out the show tonight, Mr. Bruce Baird, the founder of Nationwide Golf Schools and National Golf School for Women, a new venture that he's been starting up. A great, worthy cause. We both have some people in common that we know that we're going to help with that program. And, of course, my new show coming up in April 8th, starting with none other than LPGA teacher professional Cindy Miller, who's going to be joining me as co-host on that as well. And that's beginning the 8th of April on the Women of Golf program, and I'll give you all the information that in the weeks coming before we start. But that'll be every Tuesday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time for 1 hour. Cindy and I will be talking with some of the best in the business, both on the LPGA Tour and, of course, in the teaching side of it as well. So I want to thank, again, my guests this evening, Lloyd Higley and John Dunnigan, for helping out in Coach's Corner. And thank you, Bruce Baird, for sharing your knowledge and insight in many, many years' experience in the golf game. And you can visit Bruce's website, both of them, at www.weteachgolf.com and nationalgolfschoolforwomen.com. And if you want to talk to Bruce and find out about his upcoming date outside the inaugural event for the National Women of Golf School, that's going to be in Atlanta on May 18th to the 21st. You can give him a call at his number, Bruce Baird, at 800-894-9593. I want to thank all of my listeners for tuning in each and every week. God bless every one of you for tuning in. I appreciate your continued support. And don't forget to tune in every Thursday night here on blogtalkradio.com's Golf Talk Live. Thanks, everybody. Have a great weekend. And I will see you next Thursday right here on Golf Talk Live. Good night, everybody.